We're the Inspire Podcast. We're dedicated to bringing you the latest research in medicine, dentistry, veterinary medicine, and everything in between, from both students and academics in a language everyone can understand. Today, I'm joined by my co-hosts, Natasha, Ellie, and Halima.
If you want to get in touch, please email us at inspirejournalpodcast@gmail.com. You can also find our website at inspirestudentjournal.co.uk, where you can access original research and articles from students or find out about how you can get involved.
So just a reminder that it's your last chance with 1 week left to enter our competition. All you have to do is go onto Facebook or Instagram and like, share and tag a friend in the competition post to be in with a chance of winning a £50 Amazon voucher.
In this episode, we spoke with Dr. Siva Paul, who is currently a consultant paediatrician at Yeovil District Hospital with a special interest in gastroenterology and medical education. We discussed all things celiac disease, and Dr. Paul also shared his valuable top tips of getting into research.
We are absolutely delighted to have Dr. Siva Paul with us today. Dr. Paul is a consultant paediatrician currently at Yeovil District Hospital with a specialist interest in gastroenterology and medical education. He has over 300 publications in covering a wide variety of areas in clinical research and has also co-authored the MRCPH Clinical Practical Guidebooks. So thank you, Dr. Paul, for joining us today. How are you?
Yes, fine. Nice to catch up with you guys. And thank you. Yes, I'm fine today.
Good. So just to kind of kick us off, do you want to give us a little kind of summary of how did you get involved in clinical research and how did like your interest involving medical students in research start?
Right. Yes. So that's a very interesting question. I think when I was a medical student, I hardly had any interest in clinical research. And that was the last thing on my agenda. And I was very interested in student organizations and how to improve the services for the wider interest of the patients. But then gradually I started realizing that that is very good, what I used to do. But it is also very important that for progression of science, all of us has to do our bits. And gradually I started becoming interested. Initially, I would really do very little stuff and mainly join sort of, you know, good audit projects, maybe do some data collection. Well, this is slightly different, slightly deviating from the story, obviously. I was sort of struggling with my membership exams for a long time. And that probably culminated in my writing the book and my experience on how not to fail the exam. That has helped candidates from around the world. And when I hear from my registrar colleagues, my SHU colleagues, I really feel very proud and very satisfied in a way that I did that project, which has helped so many people to pass their exams over the last 10 years. Then, obviously, as a way to keep me sane, I started looking for other interests and other sort of achievements, and probably the clinical research was sort of stemming from that. I started collecting data, I started writing small papers, and then gradually sort of built up on that. Now, involving students, yes, that's very important. I think my first student project was probably in 2011. A student from St. George's came to do an attachment in Chichester, where I was working as a registrar, and she wanted to do something and asked me whether I've got anything which I can help her with. She said, see, I'm a graduate student. I did not do a BSc year, so it would enhance my CV. And I said, yeah, absolutely fine. So we wrote nothing sort of extravagant, just an article on childhood immunizations. And that was probably my stepping stone into involving students in addition to clinical activities, to academic activities. So that's what I would say is my starting point.
So why do you think, I mean, you said that was kind of your stepping point into clinical research. Why do you think clinical research is very important?
Yeah, thanks, Natasha. I think, yes, it's a very interesting question. When I ask my colleagues, the standard answer I get I'm talking about senior colleagues, not students or registrars or SHOs. And the standard answer I get from them is, we are busy. There is so much work to do. And it's for people who have already established to do clinical research. But I started thinking, yes, I may not be an established researcher. I'm talking about a few years back. But still, I can make some difference with my work, with my interest, and with my enthusiasm. And in reality, I have made some difference. I'm not saying a lot, but I've made some differences. An example of this would be when I was a senior registrar in Bristol doing my pediatric gastroenterology training, I started collecting data. Again, this follows on from a student project who was a Bristol student, did an ESCC project with us. Mm-hmm. And the data collection was a good starting point. And I started realizing the actual data, what was being collected, is interesting, but there are some side arms to the data. And that became more interesting. And that culminated in a paper called Asymptomatic Celiac Disease and the applicability of the no biopsy pathway for children. And that made to a publication in 2018 in Journal of Pediatric Gastroenterology and Nutrition. And subsequently, the European guidelines were changed in 2020. And my paper was one of the contributing papers which led to the change in the guidelines and inclusion of asymptomatic celiacs, such as children with diabetes, hypothyroidism, first degree relatives with celiac disease, not to need biopsy for a number of other reasons where they do not need a biopsy. So it's interesting how a little piece of student work picked up by me and supported and went further to make a change in the European level. So all of us, I feel, can make a change. But again, it is very important that all of us contribute a little. I'm not talking a huge lot of research everyone has to do. But if people contribute a little bit, it will make a huge difference in the world of science and how the knowledge progresses, mm-hmm. and how little things can actually lead to big changes.
I think you touched upon kind of the question that I want to ask, but quite a lot of the time when you talk to doctors, you almost have kind of these two camps. If you have the clinicians and you have the researchers, and sometimes you can notice, I wouldn't say animosity, but a bit of kind of like elbow in the ribs kind of between the two, where clinicians can sometimes feel that head up in the clouds, more concerned with the macro level stuff than the individual patients. But do you think, and you did kind of touch on this, but do you think that clinical research can have a real kind of interpersonal level impact on patients as well? Like, would you say that your research has impacted the way that you treat your patients?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you. I think, yes, it does, actually. The reason is, now, if you divide researchers into pure basic science researcher who are doing the big stuff like finding vaccines, making a change at a cellular level, then there is a group of researchers who are implementing it in the field and as well as doing research to understand what's the impact of that. And then it comes to the clinical level of research where you are doing a clinical work primarily, but you are picking up ideas and thoughts which can actually make a huge difference in the sort of grassroots levels. Now, if you think for, just celiac disease as a condition, there are lots of research going on to find a cure. So this is not what I'm involved in. What I'm involved in is something which is more applicable in a wider level, and I'm talking about now than 30 years later. But again, each researcher has got their own ways of doing things, and each has got their own, I would say, importance in the field of research. Now, coming to your question, sorry, I slightly evaded the question, I feel. The thing is, you have to remember that whatever you're doing, whether you're doing basic science research, whether you're doing implementation research, or either doing clinical research, all our aims is to improve the quality of life for our patients. And if that is the common goal we have, I don't think there should not be any animosity between researchers and clinicians. And they should go hand in hand in moving things forward. And that's where I see myself as having an important role.
I just wanted to kind of build on, I guess, what you've just said. But I wondered, in some of the research that I've done in animals, like more of a literature review kind of style, where I've been looking at how to treat post-operative pain in rabbits, and you sort of find that one dose is better than another dose, and that's the sort of conclusion of your paper. How do you go about translating the results of a project like that into clinical practice? Are there quite a lot of other hoops you have to jump through, or are you able to just kind of read this piece of research and say, okay, X is better than Y, let's use X now, or let's up the dose now, or how many other sort of processes are there before it translates from being published research into seeing that impact on the patients, if that makes sense?
Absolutely. I think that's a rather very interesting question, because obviously the research that is done in and any intervention that is introduced in the humans, I suppose they're slightly done at a different level. The reason for that is there are a lot of ethics and there are a lot of loopholes which has to be sort of addressed before it is translated into clinical practice. If you see in real clinical practice, it takes probably 5 to 10 years often from the publication of the first paper to actually coming into clinical practice. So that is, I'm talking about the basic science research. But if you're thinking for clinical research, it's slightly different, because you are actually trying to change the clinical practice. You're not trying to change the way a condition is treated. So those things probably are much fast-tracked and much faster.
Definitely, thank you. So it's quite reassuring that in clinical research you are able to sort of see the changes a lot faster rather than having to wait the sort of 10 to 15 years.
Yeah.
I think one question that I had was, some listeners may come to the idea of doing research later on into their education or in their training. You know, would you have any tips for those sort of people in getting into those research and like trying to find what they're passionate about?
Yeah, this is probably something which I passionately hold to my heart. And probably you've asked the question, which I always try to sort of, you know, preach and practice. Now, my belief is the earlier you get involved in research, you remain more interested and more, you know, focused on it. Having said that, I'm a prime example. I started doing even my minimal clinical research probably after 10 years of graduation. So yes, you can still do it. You can still build it up. But what I do, and that's my change in practice, is I try to involve the students as early as year one when they go into medical school. And I'm open to taking dental students, veterinary students, if there is a common ground where you can do a research on something or look into a study and things. It doesn't stop that just because someone is not a medical student that they should not do something with a doctor or vice versa, I'm talking about. And that is why it is very important to sort of, you know, kindle the passion of research very early in people's career. Whereas if you think someone is interested, they will find their way anyways, whether it is as a student or 10 years later, like me, they will find their way out of it. And often, I think if the question was how to make a start and what are the steps and loopholes you have to go through, I think the first step is to have an interest and have a realistic idea of what you're able to commit. Because at the end of the day, I can have a project which can take 5 days. I can have a project which take 5 months. And depending on what the availability of the student or the junior colleague or even a senior colleague is, you'll have to come to a common agreement to say, see, this is achievable within this time frame. Then you have to find the right supervisor. And the most important reason for that is if you are on different sort of level of expectation and different level of what can be offered and what can be expected and accepted, you may not be able to do a proper good thing together. An example of this, without taking any names, I had a student from Cardiff University, very much interested in sexual and HIV medicine, and something which probably I had some idea, but not a lot of idea. And the student is doing very well at the moment, has published papers, is doing good talks and things. And although we met on a common ground on a study day, but we never did things together, but we're still in touch and appreciating each other's research and, you know, academic challenges and academic achievements. That's what I would say. So the second step is to find a supervisor who is on the same level as you want them to be. The third thing is the supervisor has to have keen interest in students. And that's the most important thing. If you feel this is something which is an additional workload for you, rather than actually this is something which is making a difference to people's lives, starting from myself, because I do benefit from that research as well, to the student, to actually the consumer, which are our patients, then you certainly will take it as a passion, not as a workload or an increase in workload. And that is what makes a difference to the research and the researcher. And last but not the least, to have realistic deadlines on when to finish, when it should be published, and how it should go forward with. Because it's all very good to say, yes, I'll do something, but if you leave it for 6 months, 1 year, it'll never happen. So start early, find a correct supervisor, ensure that you've chosen the right person who has got a passion for research, and jump in basically.
Yes, I completely I agree with those points, because I, as you know, Dr. Paul, this was I got involved with research through you. You were my kind of first supervisor that I've ever had, and I got involved through the Inspire program, and I've always been really grateful for that experience because I think that launched into so many wonderful things. I'm still working with you on several projects at the moment, so it's been great. So my question would be, how important do you think are programs like Inspire, and kind of how did you get involved in such programs?
Right. Now, am I allowed to tell the truth, or am I have to tell it in a slightly politically correct way?
Tell us the truth.
Truth.
Right. So this comes back to matching the student to the supervisor. Now, when I used to do my ESCC project with Bristol University, I always used to choose my student because I wanted best for them and I wanted best out of them. Now, if these two factors doesn't mix and match together properly, there will be conflict of interest and there will be a project which will be half done or not even done properly, and it's just a sign of exercise. I never like sign of exercises, and I'd rather not do anything than do something which is actually leading to a change or something which will actually make a difference to a lot of people, including the people who are involved in it. So when I moved to Torbay as a consultant, I started exploring with Plymouth and Exeter. Bristol was still part of my bigger picture, but obviously the distance factor and things created issues. And I started exploring what is available. So I was told you can do some research weeks and things, or research SSCs. And SSUs, they call it SSUs as far as I understand, Natasha. And initially, I thought, okay, it's a good idea. Then the next question I asked, am I allowed to choose my candidates? No, it's a toss of a coin. Okay, am I interested? Yes, but not to a great extent. The reason for that is, if I have no say or control in what I am doing, I cannot do a good work. So the next best option that came to me as a sort of, you know, blessing in disguise, because I did not jump into the other things, was the Inspire project, where very enthusiastic students came forward. They spent their Saturday with me going through a sort of taster day and going through brainstorming and things. And I had the option to choose them in who I involved in my research. And the resultant was that we got very good outcomes from all the Inspire projects, what I have done so far. And in the first year, I did 3, 2 with Plymouth and 1 with Cardiff, had led to national level presentations, publications, and sort of wide exposure to it. In the COVID year, which was last year, I still managed to do some, and I had probably about 2.5 students. The half came because they did not come through Inspire, but they came under the Inspire umbrella. They got a bursary, but not Inspire bursary. And all of them did great work, actually. And the papers are being, either be already published or being published or in peer review. And there was another student from Exeter who did great work, not directly with me, but under my umbrella through a colleague in Edinburgh. And she did great work, and that will lead to a very sort of, you know, good paper in a high impact journal and will make a difference to the clinical practice. So put it this way, it was my selfish needs to go to Inspire, because that way I've got much better control and much sort of better option of actually finding students who are really enthusiastic, who are really wanting to make a difference and understand the process, participate in the process wholeheartedly, rather than being as a sign of exercise from the university. And really, these have made huge difference to their careers and CVs, I'm sure. And overall, I think a lot of them are actually still continuing to do some work with me, like Natasha is. There is a girl from the Cardiff University who is year four, still doing some work with me. And these are making huge differences. Now, do I believe that the university SSCs, ESSCs are important? Yes, they're extremely important and they should be done, definitely. But probably I'm not the right person to supervise it. That's all I can say. As I mentioned very clearly, you have to have the right candidate with the right supervisor. And I'm not probably one of them. So there are other people who I'm certainly will be doing it. And there is no right or wrong answer about it.
I think that's so true. Like, I know people who are really struggling at the moment because they aren't really on the same wavelength as their supervisor. So I think it's really nice to hear that you actively look for your students. You're not able to pick the people that you want, and they're also able to pick the supervisor that they want. I completely agree. I think it's really important to have a good relationship with your supervisor. I guess that's more of a point than a question. But yeah, I just wanted to say it's a good point.
Yes, I agree, Simon. It is very important that the minds have to meet, you know, to say, yes, we have a common interest in doing something.
Yeah.
And I usually let my students choose. I lay out a few project ideas and let them choose what they want to do. I do not say what they need to do. I only lay out the projects to say, see, these are on offer. What do you want to do?
Yeah.
Because if you choose something which you feel passionate about, you'll do it much better than something which I give to you with a sort of idea to say, do it. And I do not believe in that. I always is led by the students than by myself leading the students. Obviously, I sort of guide them, hold their hand in the initial days. And as they get better and better, I give them independence. And this is very important as well, to know when to let go.
No, I agree.
Like, yeah. Kyle, if you're trying to teach a bicycle and when to let go the stabilizers, when you need to go the cycle. There's something similar. All of us are in the same sort of way, in a different sort of, well, that's just an analogy, obviously.
It allows you to have more of a, we kind of touched upon it in previous episodes, I think. Like, I think research is quite creative. And I suppose if you're sort of in charge of designing your research project, then you're going to, like you say, do it better because you're genuinely passionate about it and you're genuinely interested in the topic, rather than just being told, this is your research project, this is what you've got to do, go get the data. Then you're almost bored. And then I guess that would put maybe a bit more of a strain on the relationship between the student and the supervisor, because you feel like you have to do this, or you're not fully interested in it as you would be if you were to choose the topic.
I also think it gives a degree of ownership. You have a personal investment in the project as much as what the outcomes of the project will be as well. So I definitely agree with that. So your work heavily focuses on celiac disease. Is that right in saying then?
Well, probably that's only half of my story. Other half of the story is, no, it's not really. I have done research in other branches of pediatrics as well, including things like looking at the neonatal infections or sepsis, looking at, you know, children with meningitis or suspected meningitis, then in other parameters like eating disorders in children. So I've done a lot of other work as well. So I've not sort of, you know, kept myself focused, although my focus is still gastroenterology, but what I'm trying to say, I've not kept myself restricted to just one branch of specialty, I have sort of expanded my horizons much farther than that. So I see myself more of a general pediatrician with strong research interest in everything what is pediatrics.
First of all, because our listeners might not know what celiac disease is, could you give us a very, very brief understanding of celiac disease and IBD?
So celiac disease is an immune-mediated condition seen in, and is a genetically programmed condition where individuals are creating autoantibodies to a group of food products which has got containing gluten. Initially, if you read papers from about 30 years back, we used to think it's a childhood condition and is only a gastrointestinal condition. However, over the last three decades, we have realized that this is not a condition of early childhood only. You can get diagnosed with celiac disease anytime in your life. The manifestations are not just restricted to the gut, but much wider implications, and such as, you know, severe iron deficiency anemia, or something which may be interest to my dental colleagues would be dental enamel defects. Interestingly enough, there are a lot of manifestations in the mouth, which probably my general dentistry colleagues may not know, and I'd encourage them to read a paper which I've written with a few colleagues, probably in 2016, the British Dental Journal, a general overview of celiac disease for the dentist. And this would be an interesting paper for them to read. And they can often, and I remember one of the dentists actually picked up a problem with very shiny teeth and seeing through and through very transparent teeth. And they were not sure exactly what was the reason, but they raised the alarm bells and asked the GP to test. And then they realized this person has got celiac disease and the only manifestation had was dental enamel defects. So at the end of the day, this probably would have been diagnosed if you ask me, yes, but maybe a few years later, not within the next 2-3 months. So yes, all of us can make a difference in whatever specialty we work. We are gradually realizing that people can get diagnosed even in their 70s and 80s with celiac disease. So this is a condition which is not just in childhood or preschool children or early school age. It's a wider spread condition and which has got multifacets. The more I know about it, the more I read about it, I'm more fascinated about it. And there's so many aspects to it. Now, coming to inflammatory bowel disease, this is an immune-mediated condition where there's inflammation of the gut. Now, in children, it's slightly different and they behave slightly differently because a lot of children can have inflammatory bowel disease, especially Crohn's disease, in the upper GI tract or upper gastrointestinal tract. And that's where the practice with the adults vary, because in adults, if you have got no upper gastrointestinal symptoms, you will never get an upper GI endoscopy. You'll only get a colonoscopy. But the standard practice in children or pediatric age group is to do an endoscopy, both upper and lower GI. And in addition, we'll do an MRI of the small bowel to look at the missing link. So that is another condition which is very interesting. I've done some work with it at a national and multi and in multinational studies, and have contributed. So this is something which is, again, we are increasingly recognizing that there is an increasing cohort of population who are being diagnosed with inflammatory bowel disease. And this is something which we have studied in the Southwest, presented at national and international meetings, something, a paper which I'm about to write about. And again, this is a ever-expanding knowledge field, inflammatory bowel disease. When I was a student, the only medicines I knew about for treating inflammatory bowel disease was sulfasalazine and steroids. Now it is so much wider. There are so many various immunosuppressants. There is something called elemental feed, or something which is called the astronaut's feed. And that's an interesting story in the way that this feed was actually, because when you go into space, your digestive capacity decreases because oxygen is less, although you're in a pressurized chamber, and you have to produce nutrition in a packed manner, in a way which is easily digestible. So it's a semi-digested feed in a way. And someone had a friend who was an astronaut, one of the researchers or clinicians. And they said, well, this is a good thought. Why don't I try in my IBD patients? And they got miraculous benefit. So in a way, that helped the gut inflammation, its recovery time, and putting the patient in remission with the steroids. So this is a steroid-sparing agent. So that is an ever-expanding field of knowledge, inflammatory bowel disease. And I encourage the students to find researchers and find, you know, clinicians who are doing work with IBD primarily to get involved and read and learn more about it.
Thank you, Dr. Paul. That's really interesting, especially like the involvement, like how celiac disease and what it means and who it affects has evolved. And like you said, like without clinical research, that I don't think you would have discovered that really. So I think you mentioned kind of guidelines that have been kind of published in 2020. I believe there were guidelines published in 2012 as well, the ESCON, ESPGHAM, guidelines between 2012 and 2020. And there were quite a few changes, especially regarding the non-biopsy pathway. Would you mind kind of briefly summarizing what the main differences are and kind of the clinical implications for it?
When the guidelines came out in 2012 with the revised ESPGHAM guidelines, the group suggested that children who are symptomatic has got a tissue transglutaminase titer of more than 10 times upper limit of normal, has got an anti-endomycial antibody positive, and are positive for HLA-DQ2-DQ8 haplotype, can be diagnosed safely with celiac disease without a biopsy. Now, gradually we started realizing that we are excluding a group of people who are asymptomatic but from high-risk groups such as type 1 diabetes, has got hypothyroidism, autoimmune hypothyroidism, then first relatives of celiac patients who are high-risk groups again. Can we include them? That's one aspect that has changed. The second aspect that has changed is, and again, something which I published about as well when I was in Bristol, is how the genetic testing can be misinterpreted as a diagnostic marker for celiac disease. And so this is something which we have published and other groups from Europe has published as well. People were not even aware that in the same Southwest region, I'm just giving it for an example, we had 5 or 6 different values for the tissue transglutaminase titers. And an example of this would be very simple. In the city of Bristol, we had 2 labs, one in South Mid, one in Bristol University Hospital, Bristol. And in South Mid, the cutoff was 4, and in the University of Bristol, it was 10. So depending on which patient cohort you are from and where you saw a consultant or a GP, if you have to go for the no biopsy pathway, the cutoff could be a 40 or a 100. Now, depending on when you ask whoever is on the other side of the phone to say, see, X and Z are my patients, they have got a TTG titer of 42. Do they need a biopsy or a non-biopsy pathway? Now, until and unless the person who is on the other side of the phone is actually aware there are differences in the TTG titers, because they're sitting in Bristol Children's, they will say, well, this patient needs a biopsy. But in truth, that is more than 10 times of upper limit of normal. They do not need a biopsy. Just because they're not aware that there are different cutoffs existing, people can make a sort of wrong, I'm not saying a wrong, but probably an inappropriate decision where a biopsy and available NHS resources could have been saved. It's not inappropriate to get a biopsy, but it may not be necessary to get a biopsy. That's what I'm trying to sort of focus on.
So patients that were offered biopsies, were they the ones that were asymptomatic or symptomatic? Sorry.
Okay. Right. So this is on a number. It's a numbers game.
Right.
So if your TG is more than 10 times, I'm talking about the 2020 guidelines. If your TTG is more than 10 times, you do not need a biopsy. So you go with the no biopsy pathway. If your TTG is less than 10 times, you need a biopsy.
I think what I've definitely been taught is that a biopsy was considered like a diagnostic alongside the anti-TTG. So is the thinking now changed that if your blood results meet above the range, that is enough to be diagnostic?
Yes, I would say in the right context. Now, if you're someone who is 85, and you had a previous diagnosis of some sort of cancer or something, and your TTG is, say, 20 times, just for an example, I think there will be no clinician in the right frame of mind be diagnosing by the no biopsy pathway. They'll go for an endoscopy. But if you're a healthy young adult at 35 who has got some symptoms and whose TTG is that high, I think there should be no hesitancy in using the no biopsy pathway. And in children, we do not see GI cancers that often. It's very, very rarely we see GI cancers. And they present very differently. So as I said, in the right context, yes, it's a very safe pathway.
Thanks. I was just wondering, just to clarify, in terms of, so you said that there was a kind of, each laboratory had their own cutoff levels. Has that now, is that now being standardized to the 10? Or is that still, you know, at different levels
across all laboratories? Yes, it is very interesting question, Natasha. Watch out for the space, because some of my students have just repeated the survey again. And I can give you, between the lines, that the results are slightly different, but not much different. So there is huge amount of, you know, diversity in the numbers and the essays still existing in the UK, even at a regional level. So what's the space? We are about to write the paper, and we'll be publishing it with our adult colleagues this time, because it will be affecting the adult colleagues as well, not just the pediatric colleagues. But another interesting aspect and facet what we found by doing the studies, you know, I'm talking about mainly the adult studies, is that there is about 25 to 30% of the people who has got a positive celiac test, on the blood test I'm talking about, who never had a visit to the hospital or to a specialist for confirmation of the diagnosis. So there are a lot of cases who are still being missed in the primary care for whatever reason. And there is need for huge amount of in-depth and correct knowledge and implementation of the guidelines if you have to make a difference to our patients' lives. Yeah. Because celiac disease on face value is just a simple condition. You don't eat gluten, you don't eat wheat, and you are fine. Yes, true, very true. But this is not a celebrity diet. This is actually a medical treatment for a condition. People have made it into a celebrity diet to say it's a healthy lifestyle choice, not eating gluten. But that's not the truth. It has got its own implications as well. I'm not touching and going to that, because that's not the research I do. But I do read about it. But coming back to a more sort of, you know, grassroots level, I think our sort of primary care colleagues and our colleagues from the laboratory all need to sort of join hands to move things forward, so that every patient or individual who gets a new blood test for a celiac screen and comes back as positive is put in the right pathway for investigations and further management.
You said that you were branching into the adult research as well, extending your research, should I say. Is there a difference in how celiacs typically present in adults versus pediatric patients?
Yes, in a way. Now, if you divide the celiacs into preschool, primary school, adolescents, and adults, now, primarily, children who are presenting in early life, like around the time of weaning or thereafter, most often they will present with GI manifestations or gastrointestinal manifestations. As you grow older, it becomes a mixture of things. Now, in the bigger picture, if you think abdominal pain, that's a common problem. Up to 25% of adolescents and young adults do have abdominal pain, on and off. And if that is the trigger for diagnosis of celiac disease, we probably are picking up more, which is good in a way that we are making a difference, but the abdominal pain doesn't go away, because the abdominal pain is a biopsychosocial trigger rather than celiac disease trigger. When you're talking about the adolescents, what the trend we see is usually more towards extra-intestinal manifestations rather than GI manifestations, such as, you know, iron deficiency anemia, not being corrected with iron, than vitamin D deficiency, or delay or progression in puberty. If you go for young adults, you might have issues such as infertility, early osteoporosis.
Right, okay. I didn't realize that could be.
So manifestations
keep
changing a bit.
And as severe.
Yeah.
Say, there are so many facets to celiac disease. And I've got a colleague in Edinburgh who is very much more passionate about celiac disease than I am. I'm gradually getting more passionate. And his whole time goes into doing whatever celiac he can get his hands on. And it actually is making a difference.
And I guess, is there a reason why one patient might suffer GI symptoms versus a patient who might suffer fertility problems as a result of celiac disease?
Yeah. See, at the end of the day, this is a malabsorptive condition. And it can present in different shapes and form. And that's what I would say. Like someone like me who eats rice as my staple diet, I might have celiac, but I never got diagnosed because I do not take enough wheat. Whereas someone whose primary diet is bread and wheat, they would get diagnosed much earlier. So although I do have malabsorption, I may have malabsorption symptoms, but I do not suffer that much. So I might present with extra intestinal manifestations than an GI manifestation. So yes, it's quite a complex condition to understand. Although on face value, as I always say, this is just a gluten-free diet.
Is genetic research something that needs to be explored further with celiac disease?
I think, yes, you are correct. It's a genetic condition. Now, why it escapes certain generation, we just don't know. Like a lot of my patients have got their grandmothers who got celiac disease. Their parents don't have celiac disease, and the next generation, two or three siblings have celiac disease.
Yeah.
So like any genetic condition, it can skip. So that is one thing. And the other thing, coming to the question whether there is scope for further genetic research, yes, there's definitely scope for further genetic research to understand why certain generations are skipped than others. Now, it might come back to the homozygous and the heterozygous. If your two parents are celiac, you're more likely to get celiac than one parent having celiac.
Yeah, I think that more as like a point, I guess, and a question. I think that I guess that there's some scope for that to be quite interesting. I know that there are links that are especially quite prevalent now when it comes to IBD and neurodegenerative diseases in particular, which is what my research is in. And I think it will be really interesting kind of looking at the genetic side of those things to think about it in the context of kind of maybe wider genetic mechanisms and things like that.
Yeah, I think the genetics studies what I've read so far, up to 98% of the population who are celiacs do usually have HLA-DQ2 or DQ8, mostly DQ2 up to about 85 to 90%, and rest DQ8. Some people can have both the genetic makeups. There are other sort of smaller DQ types, which we have seen only once in our patient group, who can have celiac disease as well. Now, that is why in clinical practice, I'm talking about, in research, absolutely, genetics is very important. But in clinical practice, we have tried to get away from doing the genetic testing for two or three reasons. One, it is not adding anything of additional value to the diagnosis. Two, when we had other genotypes or phenotypes or haplotypes we found for the celiac disease with TTG more than 10 times, when the undergone biopsy, they all had celiac disease. The third thing is it was creating confusion and, misinterpretation of the guidelines, as I explained, that is not vice versa. And last but not the least, it is a costly test. Depending on which lab you are doing it, it can cost anything between £35 to £100 for the HLA testing, depending on how your lab is contracted with you. So it's quite a costly test. Mm-hmm. And if it's not adding any benefit and it's being misutilized for wrong reasons and getting a misdiagnosis for a lifelong condition like celiac disease, I think from clinical practice, I don't think it adds much value.
Yeah, no. I was just going to say that, I think more from a... I guess from an academic point of view, it's obviously a different question to from a clinical point of view when it comes to benefits.
Absolutely. That's why I say there are three types of researchers and everyone has got their own value and we all have got something to contribute. No one's contribution is anything less than others. Just because I don't sit in a lab and do not do basic science research doesn't mean I'm any less important than a scientist in a lab and vice versa. Just because they don't do clinical work doesn't mean they're not contributing to the field of medicine. They're making a change in a different way.
I guess my next question was that a lot of students find that they've got to know their specialty like, and what sort of areas they want to do their research, because the worry is if you don't have research in a certain specialty in the future, it looks like you haven't made the effort to or shown commitment to that specialty. And I say, I guess my question to you is, do you value, let's say, an application for a job in your specialty, gastroenterology, let's say, do you value research in other areas just as equally?
Yes, because I would say definitely yes. The reason for that is by doing a research, you gather transferable skills, because data collection at the end of the day is hard work. It needs a lot of effort and a lot of, you know, persistence to keep doing it. So it doesn't matter whether you collected data for breast cancer or celiac disease or something like, you know, cystic fibrosis. At the end of the day, data is data. So I know you can do it. Two, you have got already produced a track record of research to say, see, I, although it's not in the specialty, but I have gathered transferable skills. I've got a publication out of it. I know how to write a paper, how to do a literature search for a paper. I have also understood the importance of how to put things into context, why the research methodology is so important. And guys, if you give me a chance to be in your team, I exactly know what you would be expecting from me. Rather, I'm not a novice. I am someone who is a seasoned researcher. Yes, I may not have done research in the specialty, but I have got lots of generic skills and transferable skills, which I'll bring and value to the job. That's how I'll sum someone having done something else. And I definitely will respect for whatever they have done. And I think, again, it's my selfish way of saying things. If I'm given the choice to select between two candidates and there's a research component in my post, someone who has done a lot of pediatric work and someone who has done no pediatric work, obviously the one who has done a lot of pediatric work will get a preference. But if I get someone who has just interest in the specialty, did some sort of student, you know, work and things, but have not published anything, but there is a research component to the job, I'll definitely select someone who, even if they've not done pediatrics, I probably will give preference to them, because I know this is someone who actually has got a track record of doing things and can actually be a useful member of the team with a bit of hand-holding and a bit of support. And an example of this, I would say, a cancer researcher, and she did one of our projects in celiac disease, which has been published recently. But when she did her application, I'm pretty sure she would have probably put that as one of the important points of having done research in pediatrics, although it's not directly transferred to the work she would be doing as cancer research. But that definitely gave her brownie points in the CV to say, yes, this person has got a track record of doing things. Because when you go for PhD applications, when people has to give you £3 or £4 million, most of it unfortunately goes to people's salaries, which is true as well. But they will not give it to someone who has got no track record of doing anything. Doesn't matter whether it's a specialty or not. The reason for that is if someone has handled pressure before, they have been persistent and enthusiastic and kept doing and kept logging on with the data, they will do it again. Now, if I take someone who is a lot of enthusiastic with no track record, how do I know that I can believe someone with £3 million? I'm not talking I have got that money to give it to anyone.
Yeah.
For research or whatsoever, but people do that. And the truth of the fact is they will only choose people who have got a track record. And doing student research, I think, helps that way, because you're building up a track record for yourself. Who knows? You might be one of the, you know, cut edge researcher in next 10 years. So that's how I put myself into that shoes, basically.
Okay. I think that's fair enough. I guess another question, if you don't mind taking another one from me. mentioned
absolutely.
How you wrote the book, your books, from learning from mistakes that you made.
Yeah.
And I guess if you had to give yourself maybe three tips or pieces of advice to your younger self, you know, someone either at medical student or in the beginnings of F1 and F2, what would you say? In terms of approach to research or exams or just clinical practice?
So let's start with clinical practice. I think clinical practice is very much dependent on your enthusiasm, willing to make a difference to patients' lives, and realizing that clinical practice is very different to any other sort of jobs what people do. In a way, by choosing to become a doctor or a veterinarian or a dentist, you have committed to a lifestyle which is going to be, if not a lot different, going to be somewhat different to other people's lifestyle, who has got a 9-to-5 job. They can come at 9, finish at 5 and go. So flexibility is the name of the game in clinical practice. You have to understand that you are dealing with someone who you're making a difference to their lives at the crucial juncture when they need you. So if you are a flexible individual with a passion for making a difference to people's lives, I think you can become a very good clinician through and through in your career. Now, coming back to exams now, exams are a bit tricky. For some people, it comes very natural. For some people, they have to be trained. And I was probably one of the people who needed to be trained and provided a structure on. So I'll give an example again without taking names. A couple of my trainees in Bristol, when I worked with them, they were probably the most knowledgeable trainees I worked with during my time as a senior registrar in Bristol. And there were a group of about probably 10, 15 trainees who were practicing together to pass the exam. And out of those 10, 15 people, only a couple of them failed. And those were the two people who were probably the most knowledgeable ones. And they came to me and asked for a bit of help. I said, okay, fine, more than happy to help. Tell me what have been the issues with. Well, one of them failed in communication, two communication stations. Now, being a, you know, born and brought up in England or in the UK, being taught communication in your medical school from day one, knowing how to communicate in the right context, this should be the easiest station to pass in any exams. However, when I sat down with the trainee and went and broke down into a couple of scenarios and things, I started realizing that what the trainee had is a lot of knowledge, but what the trainee was missing was the structure. Now, I only could gauge and could pick up and correct him or sort of provide some pathways or outlets was because I have realized myself how and why I was failing and how I needed to do it differently. Now, that trainee has been trained or had practiced with very, very, you know, bright colleagues of mine who probably scored probably 100% in their exams. I never failed an exam in their life. But when they trained them, they did not understand that this training was struggling, not because of lack of knowledge, but because of the lack of structure, which they would have never picked up. I could pick it up quite easily because I have gone through the same pathway. So as I said, my book is a reflection of that in understanding how to structure yourself for the exam. The other trainee who is currently doing some rheumatology research in the United States, as a one of the, you know, bright fellows or something, I'm not sure what exactly she got. And she was very good, but when it came to summarizing her thought process, she was lacking into that. Mm-hmm. And that's the structure I gave her. I did not make her any better doctor, any better pediatrician. All I gave her is how to structure herself in a thought process, mm-hmm. and how to present yourself so that you leave enough time to score the marks. And she passed. So all I'm trying to say, some people, they do it naturally. Some people has to learn the structure. And people who are very bright and have passed the exams at one go, were sort of, you know, stars in during the exams and things, probably are the people who are very good at teaching and training, but they may not be the people when people are struggling to give them the structure. And that is where my role, I see. I'm much better at providing that structure than a few of my colleagues who probably have not struggled like I am. So that's my exams thing. And research, I think we have already touched upon it through the discussions. Start early, but there is no deadline to say you can start after that. You can always make a start and always remain enthusiastic. An example of this, which probably Natasha would have realized, is a trainee who is probably becoming a senior trainee now in pediatrics, based in Southwest again, who wanted to do some work, but because of family reasons, work pressure and the commitments and possibly, you know, finding the right supervisor, she always had the interest and enthusiasm, but never started. But she started now and she has done already two projects. She's planning for the third one. And this is a space of within 3 months. So as I say, there is no deadline or there is no fixed time for air. It all depends on individuals when you need to start. But if you remain enthusiastic, you'll start at some point. I did 10 years after graduation.
Thank you, Dr. Paul. Those are some really, really helpful, I think, tips. It's been a really, really interesting discussion. We've touched on a lot of topics, really the celiac disease and the how it's evolved and the diagnostics of it has been really, really interesting, as well as the kind of the research side and involving students and the importance of clinical research. So thank you. I've certainly enjoyed it.
Thank you, everyone. I think it was a brilliant discussion we had. Lot of thought process which has gone through you guys for framing the questions and things and inviting me to join it. Thank you very much. All the best. Right.
I think we can all agree that Dr. Siva Paul brought up a nasty to celiac disease and inflammatory bowel disease that I at least didn't think was possible. I think his honesty with his failings and triumphs through his career will definitely resonate with a lot of us, including our audience. And I don't know about the rest of you, but it was definitely nice to hear the student success stories and research and how they helped shape various pathways in paediatric celiac disease.
If you want to get in touch, please email us at inspiredjournalpodcast@gmail.com or contact us through our social media. We've been Ellie, Sam, Natasha and Talima bringing you another episode of the Inspire Podcast. Please like or follow us on Instagram, Facebook and Twitter at inspiredjournalpodcast and subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Spotify or any other podcasting platform. Don't forget to leave us a review so we can continue to bring you the content that you love. We really are passionate about research and we'd love this podcast to reach as many people as possible. So please share with your friends and on social media. The Inspire Podcast is brought to you by the Inspire Student Journal. You can visit our journal website at www.inspirestudentjournal.co.uk to find out more. See you next time.
We're students and we're all still learning, so we appreciate any comments, feedback or error corrections in relation to the topics discussed. All research presented is correct at the time of recording. Any medical information provided does not constitute official medical advice. Consult your own physician for any medical issues that you may be experiencing. Views expressed in the Inspired Journal podcast are of the hosts and guests and do not represent the views of the Inspired Student Journal or of the institutions we are attached to.